I've been playing with the Ubuntu Snap Only Desktop Preview.
Okay. Does it work?
Well, for some value of work, yes.
Did you install it on a Mac?
No, I didn't. So, for those people who don't know what this is, Snaps have been around for a long time, like 2015, 2016 or something. They've been around. And they were designed originally as a packaging format that goes along with something called Ubuntu Core, which goes on devices like routers, set-top boxes, top-of-rack gateways, all that kind of stuff. And the whole thing is read-only, other than the writable areas like your home and log directories and stuff like that. And over time, Canonical have wanted to make a desktop edition that was like this, the read-only, everything is a snap thing. Back in the day, it was called Ubuntu Personal, but that name died out at some point.
Thank goodness.
Yes. And I'm aware that this thing existed through, you know, connections at Canonical, but it's not been heavily advertised. So it's not promoted or anything yet. So it's early days.
So what was your clue that this thing existed and it was worth seeking out?
So every so often I have a chat with the internet's George Castro, who is an ex-Canonical person, and he's the person behind Universal Blue, UBlue. And he's very interested in these read-only, immutable desktop type things. He builds one. UBlue is like that. But he does it more from the using cloud principles of CI/CD pipelines to build your image, that kind of stuff.
Right.
And I know that he chats to people at Canonical. And so he heard about this thing. And I used to work at Axiom with a guy, Ted Gould, who also talks to people at Canonical. And he's been running a snap-only thing. He's big into it. And so I heard through friends that this was a thing. And for some reason, I had some spare time recently, and I went looking for it, and I think I pinged someone at Canonical and said, hey, is there an image I can download? And they said, no, we're not pushing it at the moment because it's not ready. And I thought, well, that sounds like a challenge. So I went looking, and yeah, the fact that they said, we're not promoting it. Not there isn't an image. They said we're not promoting it. I was like, okay, that sounds like there is one and I need to go and find it.
So the internet is your haystack and an image, yes, of Ubuntu Core is the needle with which you are seeking.
Yes. And it turns out I could focus my attention on one small section of that haystack, the GitHub section of that haystack, and I found it. And it's basically an image you can download, or you can download the repository, clone the repository, and run a couple of commands to build the image locally. And what you end up with is an image file that you can splat onto a disk or a USB stick and boot it up and have a play with it. And what you end up with is something that looks very much like a standard Ubuntu desktop, but apt doesn't work and all the applications that are pre-installed are snaps, and you have a graphical desktop, and it looks, to all intents and purposes, like a normal Ubuntu environment. But I thought I'd have a play with it on a weird, quirky machine, my Steam Deck. And so I splatted the image onto a USB key, and then I've got a USB key that's got USB-A on one end and USB-C on the other end. It's this one key. And so I could DD the image onto it and then plug that into the top of the Steam Deck and boot from it. You might ask why. It was like the nearest computer I had, and I thought, well, it'd be fun to try it out. So I tried it out. And because I knew that Steam was available as a snap, I would be able to do snap install Steam and then use my Steam Deck with Steam, but running on Ubuntu instead of running on Steam OS.
Wow.
It's like swapping out the OS, but I'm keeping Steam, and most of it worked. It was surprisingly far along for something that they're not showing off yet because some stuff doesn't work.
Installing and launching Steam is one thing. Did you actually try playing games? Did you get hardware accelerated graphics and things like that? Sound?
Yes and yes and no. So yes, I did install Steam and installed a couple of games. And one of them was Vampire Survivors, and the controls just worked.
Nice.
And yes, I presume there was some 3D acceleration because it wasn't, you know, buggy 3 frames a second or anything. But the sound didn't work. And that, I think, is something to do with the weird AMD audio driver that's on the Steam Deck. Now, The interesting thing was I went grubbing around on the internet and I found the driver and I found where people have talked about how to get that working on other normal, non-immutable distros on the Steam Deck. Because some people like swap out the OS and they wanted to try it. And I couldn't really do that very straightforwardly because it's this special kernel that's built inside a snap. But what I can do is try the newer kernels because I thought, well, maybe it's landed upstream. And the interesting thing is because the kernel is a snap, I could just do snap refresh PC kernel and then just tell it a different channel in the store because there's loads of kernels built and published in the store. And so I could just swap the kernel to a newer one very easily and reboot. And there I'm on a newer kernel. That was an enlightening thing. It didn't fix the sound problem because I think the driver's still missing something, but that's something that can be fixed. The very fact that I could just do snap refresh the kernel and just get a different one, I think was quite compelling.
So I find all of this very interesting, particularly the fact that because everything's a snap, actually upgrading the kernel was a trivial action. For those not familiar with how snaps work, a single snap can have different revisions and versions available that you can cherry pick which version you want. And you were able to find a kernel version that probably had the right stuff as it happened. Maybe there was some firmware missing or something. But you were doing this some weeks ago, because I remember talking to you about this well over a month ago. And I think as listeners hear this episode, they'll think, ah, yeah, I've seen the popular open source press talking about Ubuntu Core Desktop, but you were trailblazing with this weeks before this became sort of public knowledge.
I did ping my friend at Canonical and say, never mind, I found it. And they said, please don't blog about it. And I said, of course, because I know it's not ready. And I think they wanted to get their marketing message out and also tell the story of why it exists rather than just some rando external guy. I found this thing on the internet. I played with it and it's busted. You know, they want to tell the right story. And actually at the summit that we went to recently, they did do a good presentation about it with the backstory, how we got here, you know, what it does, what's not working yet. And so all the caveats were there. And so I think that's probably the right thing to do. I did write a blog post about it. I was sat in the bar with Wimpy before the presentation was given, writing up my blog post. And at the moment when they started talking about the presentation, I hit the button and published my blog post. I didn't say anything in there that, you know, was inappropriate or wrong, I don't think.
Or leaked anything before they'd had the official announcement. But also, that presentation at the Ubuntu Summit touched on something very important that you're just talking about here, which is the idea behind this Ubuntu Core Desktop is it's like a Lego kit of parts. And this was one of the things that they were emphasizing. We give you all of the bits so you can compose your own system. Maybe you're an IoT digital signage company and you want to stick the bits together in order to create an image that does this. And so when you were talking about replacing the kernel with a newer version that was better suited to your needs, this is entirely the point. All of these different bits connected together to make what you want.
Yeah. And I hadn't actually picked up on how important that was as part of the story until they gave the talk, which is that it's not just about having a desktop. It's not just about having a UBlue or Fedora Silverblue like thing. It's way more than that, like building an appropriate image that has the specific snaps you need for a particular use case or for a particular industry. Maybe it's a device that's attached to a milling machine and all it needs is the application that runs the milling machine and doesn't need like a full desktop and doesn't need Steam or anything like that. And so the manufacturer, well, maybe at lunchtime, the manufacturer of the machine that this thing talks to could create an appliance that has a supported kernel, all the other bits and pieces that are required to do whatever that appliance needs to do.
So I am a normal Linux user who wants a normal Linux desktop. So you've just described this thing as being read-only. How on earth do I get anything done with that kind of constraint?
Yeah, it's not really read-only. There's plenty of places you can put stuff. There's a few interesting tools that are shipped on it. And one of them is called Workshops. And it's a bit like, I think it's called DistroBox, which is like it's a window that you launch. And in that window, you'll get a terminal. And that terminal could be running anything. It could be running Ubuntu or it could be running any other distro. And then in that, you can install applications that aren't available as a snap, or you could do development work, or you can run classic, like unconfined applications. That's the goal. So a developer would be able to use this.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't be stymied by the fact that it's a large proportion of the file system is read-only, because they'd have this environment in which a window in which they can work, where they would have all the usual tools, and they can NPM install stuff and PyPy and all the other places where you install stuff. So it's not generally available. If you know where to look, you can find it and you can build it and have a play with it. I don't think they want necessarily people to file loads of bugs on it yet, because it's not ready, but it's certainly interesting to see how a full desktop could be delivered. And I guess by the time the next LTS comes around in April 2024, this will probably be offered as an option, but more importantly for them, will be offered as a way for hardware manufacturers and other system integrators to be able to deliver their own custom images. I found it interesting, and it's another chapter in the whole Ubuntu story.
Yep. And for those of you that want to know where to find it, send an email to show@linuxmatters.sh or join our Telegram at linuxmatters.sh/Telegram.
We were chatting recently about me writing an activity pub inbox using an AWS Lambda function, and I thought I would talk a bit about the tooling I used to write that function.
I'm glad, because I was wondering about this. I had no idea how you did what you did, so I want to know more.
So when you log into AWS and go to the Lambda service, you can create a function and it gives you an editor, sort of little code editor with a little file manager there, which shows you all the files that you're defining as part of your code. And it's a fairly basic editor with some syntax highlighting, but it doesn't really have the sort of full features of a desktop IDE that you might be used to. So I went looking to see if there was a better way of doing this with something a bit more fully featured.
Is the answer Emacs org mode?
Oh, of course. The answer to everything is Emacs org mode, isn't it? No, the answer that I went with in this case was VS Codeium, which is the rebuild of Visual Studio Code with the telemetry turned off, and a plugin for that called AWS Toolkit, which is published by AWS themselves. And they do a similar plugin for other IDEs as well. But what you can do with this is you create an access key in AWS and you enter that in the plugin in VS Codeium, and then it gives you access to all of the services that are supported by the toolkit, one of which is Lambda. And when you expand Lambda, it will show you the functions that you've created, and you can right click on one of those and say download, and it will download the files that currently exist there onto your local machine. And then you can have at it and edit away as you like. When you then want to run it or deploy it or test it out or whatever, you can right click on your function and say upload. And then you can pick the folder where you've been editing it locally, and you get a couple of options for how to do it. But then basically it zips them up, uploads them and deploys them in AWS. And then essentially it's ready to run. And you can do this as often as you like and sort of iterate on what you're doing.
So is any of this language specific, or have you got a choice of languages as to how you want to compose this stuff?
So Lambda functions are kind of like a layered container type system under the hood. Basically, you can pick a language to start with. And I think by default, you get the option of Python and JavaScript running on Node.js. And maybe there's one or two others. But there are also others which have been built by the community. So you could include a layer for another language instead. And at that point, you can basically do whatever you like within reason. In my case, I'm using Node.js, in which case you create what is like any other Node.js package, and you can add a package.json and install NPM modules. And then you just upload all of that with your Node modules directory and your own code, as long as you have the file in the right place with the function in the right place that Lambda knows about, and everything else can be linked from there.
How do you test it locally? Like, it runs in a particular way in AWS somehow on a machine somewhere. What if you want to just make sure it works locally? Especially, how do you do that if this is part of an interaction with your Mastodon instance or with your blog or some other like external thing needs to talk to this? Do you have to build a whole load of test cases or something?
The way that I've been doing it, because this is a fairly standalone thing at the moment, there's a way in the AWS console where you can create test files, which are basically a JSON file, which looks like the request that it gets in when you invoke the function.
It's like a fake payload kind of thing.
Exactly. And you can define these and you can run them in AWS, but that's also supported in the AWS toolkit as well. So you can create these JSON files locally and have them alongside your code and then use the AWS toolkit plugin to say invoke with this request. And then it will send that off to AWS and you get the output in Codeium in the output window. Nifty.
Nice.
Which is really nice. Yeah, because doing it in AWS itself is a bit janky, and the way it outputs the logs and the way you edit the files, like, it's actually got no real tooling for editing JSON files. It just gives you essentially a text area, which isn't very nice given how picky how picky JSON can be about its syntax. So yeah, that's basically how I've been doing it. It is also possible, another way of doing this is you can get a few different sort of Docker-based solutions which will run a Lambda-like service locally, and you can essentially invoke your code within that container and it'll be like it's running on Lambda. For my needs, that's not really required. But if you have, like you say, if you've got something which would be more integrated if you were running it for real, you might want to do it differently, or you might want to deploy a test version where you can invoke it safely without it hitting your real systems or something.
This all sounds very comfortable in terms of a development environment. Have you found that there's been any sort of increase in your momentum working on your Lambda functions as a result of having this environment available?
Definitely. I mean, the ways I've done it before are either editing in the AWS web page, which is fiddly, or having some sort of CI/CD pipeline where I'm committing it, and then that's building the code, and then using some plugin in the CI/CD system to package it and deploy it, and then having to run some command on the command line to invoke it and see the output. But doing it this way is, it's not as slick as it could be, because as I said, there's several options in the upload process, and at least in the Codeium plugin, there's not a way of setting them as, always use these options. You always have to go, yes, do it like this. Yes, use this folder. Yes, I'm happy to do it. And then it does it. You can't just say, do what I did before. So if I could do that, it would be even quicker. But actually, yes, I found it's a lot of a smoother development ride doing it this way than the previous ways I've tried.
Are you planning to write all this up in a blog post somewhere?
I should get around to that. There's all sorts of things we talk about that I should write up in a blog post. It's much easier to talk about them. But hopefully once I've got the whole ActivityPub thing a bit more good to go, I'll write a nice big blog post about how it all hangs together and how I've done it.
Nice.
Using software I found on the internet, I have cobbled together my own AirDrop-alike solution.
As a non-freedom hater, what's AirDrop?
AirDrop is a fantastic facility to Apple ecosystem users where you can just deposit files from any device to any of your contacts. So just beam a file to them from anything to anywhere, providing it's running an Apple operating system.
It's also used for comedy purposes on aeroplanes to send to all the other passengers who happen to have an iPhone with the air thing turned on.
Right.
So yes, it's most like the right way to do it is to send it to other people who are, you're the person nearby, but people use it for comedic purposes as well.
This reminds me of unsecured Bluetooth on mobile phones that people used to use at college to send each other inappropriate images.
Exactly.
Yes, exactly that. Now, I've come to appreciate AirDrop since, as a family, we all got iPhones, and my wife and daughter now use AirDrop with great efficiency to send files backwards and forwards, particularly like homework assignments for review and stuff like that. And I was thinking, what I do and listen carefully to see if this sounds familiar. I usually find myself using Telegram either on my phone or my laptop to send a file to some other device that I have Telegram installed on in order to get data from place A to place B. Does this sound at all familiar?
Yes, I do this all the time. I send a, I put a file in the saved items group chat and then go and have a look for it again later.
And maybe you also like send some copy pasted text backwards and forwards as well.
Yep.
So if you've ever done this thing and you live in a world where all of your devices are not Apple devices, but you want the convenience of AirDrop, I have cooked up a little recipe for you. And the principal ingredient in this recipe is a bit of software called LocalSend. And we will have a link to the LocalSend website in the show notes. And LocalSend is available for everything from everywhere, everything install software. So it's available for Linux, Mac and Windows. It's even available for Fire OS and iOS on tablets and Android. So you can install this thing on anything. And the clue is in the name. What it allows you to do is send a file or a folder or a text snippet over your local network. Consider that your LAN or devices that are connected to the same Wi-Fi network to any other device that's on that network running LocalSend.
So both machines have to be running LocalSend for you to send and receive?
They do, yes.
Right.
But it all works extremely well, and it automatically discovers devices that are indeed on those same local networks. And in fact, there's even a facility whereby you can just share a link. So if somebody doesn't have LocalSend installed, it can create a link that you can send to them, and providing they can access your IP address, they can access the content via the LocalSend service on your device, which sounds helpful, but it's kind of a bit janky and not the best user experience. But I found a solution to that. And in addition to doing automatic discovery, each device also has a hash code to identify it. So if you're on the same network, but you're not seeing the devices in the automatic discovery, you can simply say, I want to send this file to the device with this hash code, and you type it in, or even you can put the IP address in, you know, if you really want to go basic. And it works great. I've turned on a feature called Quick Save. So now what I'm able to do is I'm able to send a file from one machine to another, be it my phone to one of my desktops, and I don't have to automatically accept the, do you want to receive this file on the target machine? It just automatically sends the file over and sticks it in a sort of a directory that I've defined as where LocalSend deposits files. But the clue's in the name. It's called LocalSend. And I wanted something more because AirDrop doesn't have that restriction.
I can hear people typing emails and toots and tweets at us right now saying, but Martin, KDE Connect is a thing and you should be using KDE Connect. Why are you not using KDE Connect? Come on, Martin, KDE Connect.
I will answer the KDE Connect question at the end of this audio essay.
Okay.
Because this is the key thing. LocalSend is great if you're on the same network. But what if you're not? Which is the position I find myself in quite often when I'm traveling. So if we sprinkle some tail scale or zero tier into the mix, your local send can now be anywhere your zero tier network or your tailnet exists. So whilst I was at the Ubuntu Summit with Popey recently, I was able to take pictures and send them to my family using local send because we are now always on the same network wherever any of us may roam. And to do this on an iOS device, for example, Tail, Scale, and Zero Tier when they're installed as apps on your phone, and the same is true if you're using Android, effectively create a VPN profile. And as long as you've got VPN enabled, you're now on the same network at all times. And the discovery protocols for local send work over both of those providers, Zero Tier and Tail Scale. And in fact, some of my devices are on Zero Tier and Tail Scale. So I see those twice because it detects them on both those networks. So this has become a great way to send large files backwards and forwards, avoiding the limits of email attachment sizes and not having to deal with, does this person have Telegram installed, yes or no, or whatever the other messaging tools might be. So this has become a viable, on my Linux machine, being able to airdrop files to my iPhone or vice versa. It's worked out really well. But Alan made a good point, which is, well, surely KDE Connect. And I know Mark has got more experience with KDE Connect, and I have tried to do the same with KDE Connect. But on iOS, I have not had any joy getting KDE Connect on the phone to see any devices anywhere via any means, irrespective of whether or not I'm doing all of this funky Tail Scale or Zero Tier stuff. So I have tried that again recently, and I just simply can't get KDE Connect to work. But if it does work for you on Android, I imagine that this would enable you to do the same thing, and adding one of these mesh VPN solutions over the top would mean that KDE Connect could in fact expand its horizons beyond your local network to anywhere your connected devices exist.
I'm now thinking of the times I send files. Like recently, Sophie messaged us and said, could you please scan in a certificate, exam certificate, and send it to me at university? And I, yeah, sure enough, I can scan it in. But I'm thinking, what's the best way to send this honking PDF to her? And I just attached it to a WhatsApp conversation I'm having with her, because I know that she'll be able to detach that and do something with it. And I think if I could convince the whole house to install local send and Tail Scale, or just do it for them when they're not looking, then yeah, that might be a better way for me to send stuff backwards and forwards. And it would also mean they could print to my home printer from wherever they are and stuff like that. That I keep wanting to do this, but I don't know, something stops me. There are always just easier ways to do it.
Yeah. The easiest way is AirDrop, but of course, yes, that's only good to you whilst everyone's on that ecosystem, and I invariably find myself being the odd duck.
Welcome to my world.
Which is why I came up with this solution. But LocalSend is a fab piece of software. It's definitely worth taking a look at. It's open source. It's available for everything. So give it a try and let us know how you get on with it.